Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B. Today's guest is Frank Lieb, 45 years of combination experience, retired Deputy Assistant Chief of the FDNY, who has held many ranks within the organization, including Chief of Fire Academy, Training, and Safety. Currently Managing Director of the First Responder Center for Excellence, which focuses on addressing crucial issues like firefighter cancer, mental health, and suicide. Frank started out as a volunteer firefighter, following after his brother. The FDNY was never on the radar, but the individuals within the East Farmingdale Volunteer Fire Department changed his mindset when they would discuss different calls and aspects they experienced while on the job. And with that, Frank applied at a young age, got on with the greatest fire department in the world, and the rest was history. Frank attributes his success to the friends and mentors he surrounded himself with. One of my favorite quotes from Frank is, "You can fool the spectators, but not the players." With that, I present Frank Lieb.
All right, my name is Frank Lieb. I joined the fire service. Well, I first got interested in the fire service when I was 7 years old. That was around the time that my older brother joined my volunteer department. Then I had the opportunity to join our junior fire department in the East Farmingdale Volunteer Fire Department on Long Island when I was 14 years old. I spent 3 years in the junior fire department, and at 17, I became a full-fledged firefighter in East Farmingdale, and then joined New York City Fire Department when I was 23 years old in 1992. Recently retired from there after a little over 31 years, and I'm still a current member in my volunteer department.
Okay. My question to you is, was FDNY always the dream?
No, that's an interesting question. So the initial dream was to be like my brother and just join the volunteer fire department. And I did that. And being around the firefighters there, I was exposed to a lot of different career paths. And the guys that were New York City firefighters just seemed to really have, when it came to firefighting, they really had a good understanding of what they were doing. And they would talk about the trips that they went on. They would talk about the fires that they went on. And you know, with a short period of time, that was something that I wanted to do. Certainly by the time I was 18 or 17 years old, I knew that that's what I wanted to do. I took the test when I was between 17 and 18 years old. So obviously I knew that was something that I wanted to do at that point. But it was really cool, all the mentors that I had in the volunteer fire department to kind of shape what I wanted to do as a career. And you know, I'm just so blessed and fortunate that I was able to fulfill that dream and become a career firefighter as well as still be a volunteer firefighter.
Okay. And so you put in for FDNY, you get accepted. I'm assuming you had a rookie school at the Rock, correct?
Yeah. So I joined, I went into the FDNY Fire Academy in October of 1992. And, you know, it was very different than it is today. I was out of the academy in time to work New Year's, about 8 weeks long, and very different. It's almost double the time today. But the world we live in has evolved, and what we're expected to know and what we're expected to perform at, the amount of various runs that we go on today, it has changed significantly since 1992. We're expected to be problem solvers, and people call the fire department for any number of reasons, way more different reasons than they did back in the day.
All right. So upon completion, what was your first assignment?
My first assignment was to a single engine 323 in Brooklyn. And I stayed there for a little over 5 years.
Okay. And so walking through those doors, knowing that you are officially an FDNY fireman, upon walking through those doors, did you try to find those guys you wanted to emulate? Or back then, was that like a non-negotiable? It was, hey, you're here, you're going to learn how to be a fireman.
Well, I think in hindsight, I look back and I was always trying to emulate myself after the people that were that I enjoyed when they taught. And I even in the volunteer department, there were people that I looked up to there and wanted to emulate their style, how they conducted themselves around the firehouse, how they conducted themselves on the fire ground. They were cool, calm, collected, knowledgeable. So I gravitated to those people. So when I get assigned to Engine 323, I go straight from probie school. They let us know where we're going to go. So I go there. I stop at the local bakery, pick up a couple of cakes. I knock on the door. They let me in, and I meet the captain that's there, Captain Gene McGowan, and he sits me down and he tells me and he gives me a couple pieces of advice. I spent a couple of hours there that night, had dinner with them, and he tells me, learn something from everyone you meet. Sometimes you'll learn what not to do. And he said, read something fire related every day. And those are points that I took with me for the rest of the rest of my career. Something I still do today. I try and learn something from everyone that I meet. And I certainly read or listen to. There's so many ways to stay engaged nowadays that you're negligent if you're not. If you're a firefighter and you're not taking advantage of all the different ways that you could stay current, it's just insane. It's so different today. Like I said, technology has enabled us to learn using so many different mediums that we're fortunate to have that. And I met another guy. I met John Milano, Red. They called him because he had red hair, and he was literally a ball of fire. He was just so into the job, and just his attitude was infectious, and just the way he was. So yeah, I definitely. And again, in hindsight, there's so many people that that I have tried to be like, and you take the best parts of each of them, and that's you. You are without a doubt a collection of your experiences and those people that you've been exposed to, and the people that you are exposed to, well, hopefully you gravitate and you recognize the ones that are really good that stand out and emulate them. And I've again, in hindsight, I recognize certainly who those people were, and I'm grateful and thankful for all of those mentors that I had, both in the career and volunteer side.
And so, how long did you decide, or how long did you remain a tailboard firefighter before deciding to promote to the next step?
Well, I left that engine company, and when they formed, New York City formed some new squad companies in 1998. So that was when I went, and I was fortunate to go to one of those to be a charter member of Squad 270, with only 5.5 years in the FDNY. It's very difficult to get to special operations in New York City without having at least 10 years. But the captain had some faith in me, and he took me on. And I guess it was while I was there, as I was learning and other guys were going to study, and that I decided to study for lieutenant. I put together a really good study group, and I had 10 and a half years when I got promoted to lieutenant, which I don't know if you ever feel like you're ready to be, to promote, because you never know everything. And even the day before, I remember the last tour I'm working before I get promoted. And I came in, and I operated the same way I did for every other tour. I came in, I checked the rig, even if someone else had checked it, I'm going to recheck it. But typically we would check it together. 270 had a Squad 270 had a group of like-minded individuals that, would always make sure that we were checking it. So it was almost like that beginner's mindset, even on the last day before I'm getting promoted, that, I could have a career fire tonight. I could be challenged more than I've ever been. And so I need to make sure that the rig and my equipment and everything is right, and that we know it. I mean, we were so dialed in that company. I think we would take out the procedure for a tool, right? That the FDNY has. Then we take out the owner's manual of the tool, the manual that would come from the manufacturer's manual. And we would oftentimes have questions where we would call the manufacturer, and they'd be like, wow, you guys are nuts. Like, as we would ask, but we wanted to know every single thing about the tool, and especially when we talk about the limitations. Well, we would try and come up with additional uses for it. Hey, if we had this oddball scenario and we wanted to use the tool like this, could we use it? And we would try it, but we would sometimes ask the manufacturer about limitations and stuff like that. And it was cool. They thought we were crazy, but they always engaged us and gave us the answers that we wanted. Okay. Yeah.
All right. So you, after 10 years, which to me is, I think all firefighters should at least take several years before deciding to promote. But you know, different departments, different areas, growing pains, people retiring, you know, that all plays a factor. But when you became lieutenant, I'm sure during those years of you being at Backstep, you saw leaders who you wanted to emulate and leaders that you were like, no, but I also learned from that leader I don't want to be like. So how did you form that into when they pin that badge on you stating that you're a lieutenant?
Yeah, so you naturally become each of those people as you select them. But in the FDNY, you come offline, and you every rank that we get promoted, you come offline for a certain amount of times. So I think when I went to first line supervisor flips, we call it, I think it was 8 weeks at the time. So I'd come off, and that's 8 weeks of training where they're giving you leadership, management, tactics, skill, you know, all of that different stuff, to try and help you form that leader that you're going to be. And if you're not paying attention to the officers that you have, if you're thinking about promotion and you're not paying attention to the other supervisors and their leadership styles, boy, you're going to be starting from square one when you get promoted, because you got to really pay attention to what they're doing. And I had officers that they would bring me up into the office to go over the paperwork, so that way when I was by myself, I had an idea of what I was doing, and I paid attention to all of that. I was truly a student of my profession, and when I was getting ready to promote, that meant being a student and dissecting the officers that I had to make sure that I was going to be the best officer that I could be. Because being the best officer you can be on day one, you're going to make errors, right? You're going to run into a personality or situation, and you're going to look back at it at some point and be like, "Wow, I really handled that poorly," right? The way I handled that, the firefighter was not happy with the way I handled it. He or she may have handled the decision okay, but the way I delivered it, so the delivery and how we treat people, that is super, super important. A couple of months ago, I was doing a seminar in Pensacola, Florida, and I start talking about servant leadership. And I basically asked the group, I said, what keeps you up at night? And somebody said, what keeps you up at night is that we use this word, servant leadership. It's like today's buzzword. But is that really what we are, or are we adaptive leadership? And so I told him, I said, well, define each of them. Define adaptive leadership and define servant leadership. So he looks them up, and there's a lot of similarities, right? And I would say that servant leadership is adaptive leadership. It's adapting to your people. It's not blindly just treating everybody the same. Like, I have a son and a daughter. I have to talk to them differently. So it is, if five people put in for a vacation request and you can only honor two of them, well, I would hope that you're going to take care of your high performers. That there's got to be a metrics for us doing that, because if we blindly just treat everybody regardless of whether they are a high performer or not, and we're not looking at the individual traits of people and trying make our low performers better, higher performers, right? If we're not doing all those things, then the people that are our high performers, there's going to be some resentment there, and that's going to negatively impact the entire team. Because whether we know it or not, whether we like it or not, we hold our high performers to a higher standard than we do our low performers, because the expectation of the low performers is so low that we're not worried about it. So when, but when the high performer doesn't hit the bar that we have set, we are the first ones to say something to them. So that adaptiveness where you might have a firefighter on scene and you do an overhaul, you've been working a long time, we should be requesting relief when our first member is getting tired. That's adaptive leadership. Giving a vacation request to a member who maybe deserves it more because they did extra around the firehouse that you asked them to do. Those are the ways that we reward our people. Because if, I often say, have a high standard and hold your people accountable, because that's what your high performers want that. And I think you show your people that you care for them, and yes, even love them, by having a standard and holding them accountable. because a rising tide lifts all boats, and a high standard lifts all of our performers. It lifts all of the members that we work with. But we, keep in mind that we are holding our highest performers to a higher standard. Well, then let's find ways that we can reward them for really making our job easier by being the high performer into the job, because they strengthen the entire team when we have these people.
No, that's a fact. Okay. So my question to you here is, with every officer rank that you obtained, what were your non-negotiables, or did they ever change the higher you went?
Training was always a non-negotiable. We were going to train, we were going to drill, and that was just going to be a non-negotiable. On the fire ground, I'm going to make my decision on the fire ground, and I expect that my team is going to comply with the decisions I make. But if they see something or there's something going on that I may not see, I empower them to always be able to speak up, because it's a team sport, and I don't ever want to be told, "Hey, I saw that, Lou," or "I saw that," whatever. As a chief officer, and I'll give you an example of this. As a chief officer, I would have a driver's aide, and most of the time, I had the same individuals that they were very good at what they did. But occasionally, we'd get a new person, or I'd be somewhere new. And I maybe didn't know the experience level of the firefighter that was driving me. But I would always tell them that if you see something that I don't see, or you don't what you know, I need you to speak up. Because, I certainly don't I don't know it all, I don't see it all, I may not hear it all on the radio. And it could be simply, "Hey Chief, did you hear that last transmission? I think it was a mayday." "Well, no, I didn't hear it, but you heard it." And if you don't tell me, and that's an extreme example, right? But even the little things, I want you to say something, and that's critically important to understand that the speed of trust, how fast we get the trust between our team, especially when we're brand new. A brand new officer needs to get the speed. He needs to get the trust of, or she needs to get the trust of their crew as quickly as they can. I would walk into, in New York City, you get promoted, and then so you work in Queens or you work wherever, and you get promoted. So I was a lieutenant in Queens. I get promoted, I go and I work in Manhattan. So the first tour I'm working in Manhattan, I don't really know anybody. They know where I work because, it's like two dogs sniffing each other when they first meet. They're going to ask me questions. They want to know my pedigree. Where have I been? I'm going to ask them questions. But on the fire truck, on the rig, I'm going to be talking to that chauffeur, and I need to know everything about this guy or girl as soon as I can. And I need to let him know about me. He's going to tell me about the crew, and we need to get that trust as quickly as we can. And then work on the trust with the rest of the crew at roll call. Roll call was another non-negotiable. I wanted to see all the people I was working with, especially when I was in a place for, that I didn't typically work in. And there's areas of the city that they don't always have formal roll calls. But when I was there, I'd be like, "Hey, I know you don't do formal roll calls, but I just need to see everybody and understand who I have working with me. The first time I meet you is not going to be on the fire floor." And I'm sizing you up, right? I'm sizing you up to see, how long is this firefighter on a job? What knowledge does he have? We're given the positions. So you ask, especially in a place that I would typically ask the firefighters what position they wanted, no matter where I worked, even in my firehouses, when I was assigned. But you ask a firefighter, "Hey, what position you want tonight? You want the nozzle or you want the control?" So if a firefighter doesn't take the nozzle, I learn a lot about that firefighter just from him telling me that he doesn't want the nozzle. Because I want the nozzle every single day, every single tour, even when I'm not feeling well, I want the nozzle. It's just that speed of trust is so important. And to me, especially working in a ladder company, the ladder company chauffeur, the person who's driving that truck, they're so invaluable to the overall scene of an incident. You see them on the I show up as a chief officer, and that ladder chauffeur is on the pedestal, and I want some information. He knows, he or she likely knows where everybody is and what's going on. So, the gentleman who drove me at the end of my career, Driver Joe Wiz, He was a ladder chauffeur in an area where I was a battalion chief. He was working in ladder 151, and I was in battalion 4-6. So we would show up, and I would see Joe on the turntable of the ladder, and I'd be like, "Hey, Joe, what's going on?" And he'd be like, "Hey, Chief, I got two guys. They're in the top floor. They're doing a search. I heard the transmission, and it sounds like there might be fire extension to the floor above." Whatever it is, he seemed to know the answers, and it didn't matter if it was Billy Pence in ladder 136. It didn't matter if it was Joe Tarantini in 138. It didn't matter if it was Joe Wiz in 151. Like all the different companies, no matter where I was, there were so many of our chauffeurs that were so good, and they're usually, a more senior firefighter. But the information that they would get, and you don't have that now. You don't know that connection on day one, but those develop whether you're as a lieutenant, you're developing it with your chauffeur of the engine of the truck, as a chief officer, where you're developing it with all of the companies around you, and you understand how important the chauffeur position is. And I think that's to your question earlier about, members getting promoted earlier in their career. I thought 10 years was a pretty good time to get promoted. I didn't know it all, but at some point I got to promote, right? If I'm going to promote in the FDNY, you need a minimum of 3 years. The problem with promoting sooner than 3 years or even 3 years is the amount of sets and reps that you're going to get, right? There's only so many you're going to get no matter where you work. And sets and reps equals experiences. It equals diversity of experience as well. So having the ability to, not just have, well, I've had a couple of private dwelling fires. Well, okay, well, I had some strip mall fires. I had a fire in a mid-rise building, an apartment building. So the more variations you have in your experience and the more sets and reps you have, the more well-rounded you're going to be, the better you're going to be when you're an officer and you see something that is very different than what maybe you're used to seeing. And now you got to come up with a solution. And that could be a big challenge. It's a big enough challenge when you promote to be an officer, but having to, the learning curve is even greater when you have less time and less sets and reps. But with that said, there is a caveat. The members that are really into the job, that attend training, that do all they can to be better, they're watching the videos, they're listening to podcasts, they're doing all the things that they can do. You can accelerate the time needed to be ready to promote. But don't promote and think you know it all, no matter how much time. I know members that have gotten promoted to lieutenant with 20 years in the FDNY, and they knew that they had, they were still learning. They were still students of the game. You never stop. I'm still learning. I'm retired now, from my career, but I'm still learning different things. I mean, look at line of duty deaths in the United States last year for firefighters. You hear that we don't, I've heard we don't find new ways for firefighters to die. Well, that last year we had two ways in which I had never heard of, and the one was the firefighter that killed that died at a quarry fire, where the equipment was on fire and the truck tire delaminated, exploded, and killed the firefighter. Now, I can't tell you how many car fires I've been on when the tire explodes, right? The tire lets go. We all jump and then we laugh at each other for jumping, for it scaring us. But never had I thought of that tire being something that would kill me, because we had seen it so many times. And I never even equated it to what if it was a bigger tire? And then we have that. So all firefighters need to pay attention to that. And then then the chief officer who's on the highway with the refrigerated truck carrying frozen chickens. Refrigerated trucks are on the roads all the time. And this chief opened the door and it instantaneously exploded. So those are two ways. So if we're not paying attention, we'll just repeat these incidences if we don't. Now, those are two watch outs that we should be watching for. The report that just came out on the Plainfield, Indiana, Walmart distribution fire. The NFFF, the National Fallen Firefighter Foundation, did an excellent job with this report, and it just came out. And all firefighters should read that. And I think about the first time I heard about that fire, and some of the takeaways from that. I was talking to Shane Ray, who's with the National Sprinkler Association, when he talked about sprinklers and today's sprinkler systems as new technology. Those systems in that, like in that building, they had like 30 different zones, and one zone can supply 2,500 gallons of water per minute. And I think, well, how long will it take you to establish enough hose lines to flow 2,500 gallons of water? You need a sundial. You need a lot of hose lines to do that. But with those systems, all they want you to do is let them run. And I think in my career, it was always as soon as we have water on a fire, my next order, once I get that, is shut the sprinkler on. But in these buildings, you know, because I don't want the truckies to melt, you know, I want them to, you know, but they say leave the sprinkler system running and let the sprinkler system put the fire out. And when you think of the tall rack storage, some of these are 70, 80, 90, 100 feet tall. I don't want to send firefighters in there to overhaul. These are things that I just never thought about. And, you know, sprinkler systems work best when the roof is intact. That makes sense, right? The sprinkler system gets activated from the heat. Heat goes to the ceiling, drops down 18 inches where the sprinkler head is, wherever it is, right? But so if we cut a hole in the roof and some of that heat goes out, we're giving the fire some air, and the sprinkler heads may not activate as quickly as they would have. These are things that I hadn't even thought about. So that report, and you know, I've read the takeaways. I've read a lot of that. I need to reread it because there's so much information in that. But there's so many good takeaways that you need to know about these takeaways the next time out the door when you go to a big box retail, whether it's a Home Depot, a Target, a Lowe's, a Best Buy, or a big distribution center such as an Amazon, or in the case of Plainfield, Indiana, it was a Walmart distribution. And we all have some variation of these facilities. So it's a critical report that we should be paying attention to.
Okay. You stated earlier your non-negotiable was training. So what's your take on outside training, getting outside your organization, your station walls to obtain that?
Well, so it first off, it prevents an insular mindset, right? So that we know it all, that we have all the answers, and that cross-pollinization of information is critically important. So we need to make sure that we are going outside of our own organizations and attending conferences, listening to podcasts, however it is, bringing speakers in, whatever it is that you can do. And when I speak about this, I speak about the training lineage. And your training lineage is a connection of all the people that you have ever taken a class from or listened to a podcast to. So for your listeners that are listening to this episode, they now have a training lineage to you, and they have a training lineage to me. And hopefully they'll expand it off, and maybe they go to FDIC or they go to any of the other conferences, great conferences that are out there. And every instructor that they interact with, every book they read, they have a training lineage. And we strengthen that network, that web, throughout all the fire service when we do that. We are stronger together with that interconnectivity. I joke around, if we could put us on Ancestry, or if we could have our family tree, we could probably date us back to Ben Franklin. You know, we could say, okay, the relationship to this, it goes back through a training lineage, through our training network. And then I joke around and say, I don't know if I want to be connected to Ben Franklin because I never saw him inside the building. He might be a yard breather. He might have never went inside. So I told that to the Philadelphia brothers and sisters that I'm friends with several of the people who work at the Fire Academy, and some of them that used to work at the Fire Academy, and they're doing great work there in Philadelphia. And you know, so I said this about Ben Franklin when they were in the audience, and I didn't recognize how much of an affinity and appreciation they have for Ben Franklin. They got a little upset and joking around with me. They sent me a picture within 5 minutes of the end of the me talking. I had a picture of Ben Franklin inside a building, and with the caption, "Hey, Lieb, we went inside." And then underneath, they wrote on the text, "So that settles that." So situational awareness. Know where you're speaking and know your audience, right?
Right.
Not just situational awareness on the fire ground.
Okay. So, even for the FDNY, it's probably important for those members to get outside.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And a lot of our members do. We send members to different conferences, and we bring speakers in. And so, when I was at when I was the chief of training and the fire academy, we hosted several different classes. We brought in a fire dynamics boot camp to the FDNY Fire Academy. We brought in a health and wellness 2-day class. We brought in a 1-day class on occupational cancer. We brought in Gordon Graham for 1 day. So yeah, we don't, listen, no organization knows everything and has all the answers. And there's subject matter expertise in different areas all over the place. The idea is to find them and bring them in. And they don't always have to have the same viewpoints that you have. In fact, I think it's good when they have when a speaker has different points for you to consider. I think that enables us to grow as an individual, grow as an organization, and ensure that we have the best policies and procedures that we can. Because at the end of the day, leadership's responsibility is to give the firefighters, to position the firefighters in the best possible way to succeed. And that is done through having procedures that are accurate, that are up to date, and also making sure that we're giving our members the training that they need to succeed. And when we do that, because the firefighters will do anything we ask of them. Our firefighters, if we ask them to put out hell, they're going to try. Whatever it is that we tell them to do, that's what they're going to do. So it's a two-way street. It's a partnership to make sure that we are giving them the best procedures and that we're giving them the training on it. Because at the end of the day, we want to keep our firefighters healthy, safe, and we want to make sure that we're saving as many lives as we can. And the avenue to do that is through training, because safety is a byproduct of training. If you train, you get the sets and reps, you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, the safety falls into line with all of that.
Okay. As far as standards, in your opinion, should all organizations adopt some sort of standard when it comes to firefighters' performance or lack thereof?
Well, so you have to have, if you don't have a bar, if your bar is so low you're tripping over it, or your standard is that, hey, the fire went out and everybody went home, well, that's not a standard. So there needs to be a standard, a bar of what we're trying to, what are we here for? What are we trying to do? If your standard is just the fire went out, well, that's terrible. We should and must be better than that. So yes, there should be a standard. And again, our members should be held accountable to that standard as well.
When it comes to leadership, company officer, chief officers, what, in your opinion, what does true leadership look like?
Talking the talk and walking the walk, and understanding that, making sure that you're taking care of not just the external stakeholders, which is the public, right? But our internal stakeholders, which is our firefighters, making sure that that our culture is right, that our training is right. It's that whole ecosystem of what leadership should look like. But the you could fool the spectators, but you can't fool the players. And if you're saying one thing and doing another, we smell bullshit a mile away, and we see, if we see fake leadership, that, we could, it doesn't matter what organization you're in. If you have that, you're like, we have that extra sense that the point that picks that out when we have that. So, don't just pay leadership lip service. You have to walk the walk, because you're, as a leader, and I don't care what level of leadership you are, and you could be a chief, you could be a company officer, or you could be a senior firefighter who's an informal leader in the firehouse. If you're just barking orders from the couch as a senior firefighter, you're not going to get the respect of a leader, because everybody's watching the people who are in positions of leadership. And like I said, that could be the senior firefighter who thinks they're in a leadership position, right? But they're not following through. You'll undermine your leadership ability if you're not walking the walk and just talking the talk.
Love it. She can fool the spectators, not the players. I like that. I like that.
Okay. In your opinion, what do you see the fire service doing good on, and what can they improve on when it comes to recruitment and retention?
Well, so I think to me, recruitment and retention are two separate issues. We oftentimes do a, recruitment seems to, and I'll use my volunteer department. My volunteer department, we recruit a lot of firefighters, and we recruit, from all spectrums. We get white firefighters, we get black firefighters, we get female firefighters, we get male firefighters. So, like when we come to the diversity is built into what we're doing with recruitment. But the problem is we don't always retain them. So we have to look at retention as very different. And the retention is all the stuff, whether you're a career or volunteer, is and I'll talk recruitment from the volunteer because I'm more involved in that. But the recruitment from bigger departments, there's organizations, there's people that are doing that within the organization that they're recruiting. I think we should do better recruiting at through the military when it comes to recruitment. I think we should do better at recruiting from different schools and colleges because I think there's a lot of people that we could be convincing to join our profession and not necessarily schools, but also these schools that are teaching people how to be plumbers and electrician, right? All of these technical schools that are out there. These are hands-on people that would be good in a profession such as ours. But I think it's an untapped resource when we're not discussing careers in the fire service with our younger people in high school, and then we're not recruiting in proper locations. I think we pay ourselves a disservice when we do that. But now we've recruited, and now we have our people. Now, how do we retain them and make sure that they are career long or lifelong in most cases in the volunteer department? And I think that's a separate challenge. And making sure that they're included, making sure that that everybody has the same standard, all of that is critically. All of that is super super important because if you have an individual that you're working with and they're a low performer. And we allow that, that's going to have a negative impact on the fire ground. We're a team and everybody needs to be included in that team. And I've had times when a probie has saved a day on a call or informed me of something I didn't know, all the way up to our senior member or our high performers, all of that. So making sure that we have that we're inclusive in the firehouse, I think, is an important part of that. And that's a two-way street. So all of our members have to understand that they're part of a team, and they have to instilling that team concept into everybody is critically important. To me, it doesn't no matter who you're working with, we have to do a better job of making sure that everybody is a contributing part of the team. And I think that will lead to greater retention. I talked to I know Dina Alley, Chief Alley. She talks about the importance of leadership and making sure there's no stress. It's not just the calls, the stress that we get from poor leadership or from things that we may be subjected to in the firehouse. I think that's something that could be a problem. Sometimes too, but it's for me, and I'll jump back to New York City again. When with my crews, everybody was part of the team, and everybody had value, and we were able to bring everybody to the table with a common understanding. And hey, the bottom line is not all 100 watt bulbs burn at 100 watts. Some people are going to be outgoing and more in seem like they're more into the job than others. But it's positioning your people in the best position to be successful, and making sure that we're doing all we can to keep them. In New York City, we don't lose a lot of people. So the recruitment end is what gets under the microscope more often than the retention part because people stay within the organization. Very few people leave the organization once they get to a firehouse. But on the volunteer side, And not just in my department, sometimes keeping the firefighters is a little bit more difficult, and it's expensive to get a 5 or 10 year firefighter who's trained with enough sets and reps, right? That's a we don't have enough of these firefighters. So when we could keep them there, it's terrible when you lose somebody with 3 years. So finding ways to do that, there's certain challenges that are a little bit different from the career to the volunteer side. But family life gets in the way, working two and three jobs in a, gets in the way as well. But you don't know those issues if you don't speak to your people. Communications is an important part of that as well. So a lot of dynamics at play in there. I think I covered a bunch of them, at least for a couple of seconds on each.
Yes, no, you did for sure. And you brought up kind of a segue into the next question I was going to ask you. Communication amongst the rank and file. It's my opinion that successful organizations have that communication. And I'm talking about communication that where the chief of the organization can send down the line, not personnel issues, things of that nature, but effectively communicating, letting the members know what's going on within their department.
Yeah, and you're 100% right. And in the FDNY, so when I retired, I was a staff chief. So that's basically the top 20 people in the organization, and we all visited firehouses regularly. The chief of department visits firehouses regularly. So the greatest investment on my time was visiting firehouses and letting them know policies and procedures that are going on, talking to them about fires that you may have gone to, just educating them on some of the stuff because they want to see you and talk. And so often you could show up at a firehouse and the fire, they may tell you about a problem that exists that you didn't even know about. And it could be a simple solution that maybe you just make one quick phone call and that solution and that problem solved. Yet for the firefighters in that firehouse, it could be a big deal. And it could be just that, hey chief, we've been trying to get the washer and dryer fixed for like 3 months now. And we haven't been able to. Well, maybe there was a disconnect somewhere. Maybe the reports didn't get whatever it is. And I could make a simple phone call and then have somebody there tomorrow to get it fixed. And, so I like to say visit the firehouses as often as you can. It's your best return on investment. Plus, the firefighters typically know all the problems of the organizations and how to solve them. The problem is they have no idea about the politics behind it and how to do that. But the greatest return on a chief's investment is to visit and talk to your firefighters and let them know that you care. And you do that by showing up and leading with fire. When you show up, the first thing you talk about fires. Hey, you go to a fire last night? Oh, yeah, we did. Well, what position did you have? What'd you do? Start talking about the fire. I could talk tactics all day long. So we sit in there, we talk about fires. Now, maybe you didn't go to a fire, but I did. So I tell you about a fire that I went to. Now, that experience is transferred to you because, to a great degree, experiences are transferable. And I also imparted a little bit of leader's intent about what I expect at fires. So I'm giving you a little bit. And now, the next fire I have with you, we just had these conversations about this. So you're going to perform better, you're going to understand my expectations. All around, we become a stronger team. And then eventually, I'm going to get around to talking about, hey, your hours are low. I need you to work more hours, or you need to shave, or whatever the policy is that, and they joke around and they know that I came because I had to, tell them about some policy. But we just spent the last 90 minutes talking about, tactics and procedures and strategy, and they love it. And when I was a brand new firefighter, I mentioned earlier, I worked in 323 engine in Brooklyn. And in my battalion, the 58 battalion, we had a chief, Frank Montagna. And this guy would come to quarters and he always led with fire. And he always, this guy was taking pictures before anybody else was taking pictures. He would come with pictures that he had of a fire he went to. He would tell us. And I was afraid of the chiefs. I wouldn't dare talk to the chiefs. It was a different era, but I loved when they came because they always had information that I wanted. And the people that drove them were senior members of the fire department. So even those guys had stories. And, whether it's an old timer telling you a story, a war story, or the chief coming and telling you about a fire, that's all learning opportunities. And I'm all into learning because the transferability of these experiences, you can't get enough sets and reps. So these are in essence, additional sets and reps. Fire stories of yesteryear or somebody who went to a fire last night, just watching a video, those are transferable experiences and augment the sets and reps that you get that make you better.
Okay. Now, as a chief, were there ever times like, especially because, when you got to a certain rank, you had your own driver. So did you ever feel or ever have to have that conversation with your chauffeur or driver to let them know, hey, if I'm doing something wrong or if I interpreted something wrong, tell me? Because like it seems like we have certain leaders, whatever position it may be, where if you tell them like, hey, you might have done something wrong, it'll completely piss them off. It'll turn them away. It'll, shut you down. Like, so my question to you is, being in any sort of officer, should you have that vulnerability or that allow yourself to be human where you make mistakes?
Yeah, you have to, or if you want to be better, you have to, and not and you again, you have to tell your people that I want that. And then you can't yell at them when they tell you something that maybe you didn't like, right? Because that's the fastest way to shut them down. And what I would do is I would at different ranks from battalion chief on up, but especially as a staff chief, I would have my trusted people. And as a staff chief, my driver was the trusted person where I'd be like, hey, what do you think of this? And many times he'd be like, this is terrible, or you should change this. And I'd be like, all right. And that could be on the fire ground too. If I'm missing something, I want you to speak up. And that's that whole part of trust, right? When you have that trust. I remember I'm teaching a chief's education day, and I'm a fairly new chief. I only have a couple of years as a chief, and we're bringing all the chiefs, and we start with an airing of the grievances. So if you don't like a policy or procedure or something that's going on, we want you to say something. And I knew this one senior chief who I knew he had a problem with a policy, and I was trying to change this policy as well. I was not a staff chief at that point, but on the day that this other chief came, the senior chief came, we had a staff chief in the room, and I encouraged him. I said, "Please, we need to hear it. We need to hear all these because we're collecting all of them." So he opens up his mouth and he talks about he's perfect. He articulates the message exactly what I wanted him to do, and the staff chief that was in the room immediately starts screaming at him. And so then what'd this guy do? Well, first off, he was pissed off at me because he felt like I set him up. But afterwards he says, I'll never speak again. But he stopped speaking. And then the whole room chilled. Nobody spoke. And the day of training, we didn't get out of it what we should have. Instead, we would have had a great discussion on important topics. And instead we had nothing. And I apologized to the guy afterwards, and we wound up changing it, but changing the policy on what he was talking about. It just took a while. But I think part of it was probably the delivery that, I think the staff chief took it as maybe he was being a little accusatory when he shouldn't have been. But he articulated the problem perfectly. But once you yell, no one's going to talk. But I love having those conversations on strategy and tactics, especially if someone doesn't understand or maybe like a policy. And in my career, especially when I was at the fire academy, either as a chief of the fire academy or chief of training, we would have groups come in and have discussions when we were rewriting a manual, or just we had them in as a brainstorming session, and we would change policies after that. And they'd come in saying, "We ain't going to change anything. This is going to be a waste of time." And sometimes the policies don't change overnight, but I would listen to our people. We have so many smart people. So many knowledgeable people, so many people that have a lot of experience, and you got to be able to listen to them. There's got to be an avenue for all levels of the organization to communicate with each other, and visiting the firehouse, having these different meetings where these ideas and stuff can go up and down the chain of command, because we need to be able to have influence up and down the chain of command. That's critically important. And for chiefs dropping down and going into going to the firehouse, we do WebExes and different things. The chief of department will do a WebEx and talk to all the members, because that direct communication, that's critically important. It can't always be the lieutenant and the captain talking to the members. Every once in a while, the top of the organization needs to get out and speak to the lower levels, the firefighters, the officers as well, because they need to hear it sometimes from the horse's mouth. And for our chief of department and our chief of operations, they put out regular when we have a staff meeting, they'll put out the notes from that give you some information on it. But if you don't communicate, trust me, somebody in your organization is going to be communicating. It just might be the loudmouth in the kitchen, and half of that information is going to be wrong. So if you communicate, if the top of the organization has a responsibility to communicate, that will preserve culture. It just makes a healthier work environment.
Right. Okay. You mentioned earlier that with every rank of promotion, you come off the line. So when you come off the line, is that like officer development type courses, the higher you go?
Yes. Yep. Every single rank. So you get promoted to lieutenant, you're offline for 8 weeks. Get promoted to captain, offline for 6 weeks. Get promoted to battalion chief, offline for 6 weeks. Get promoted to deputy, offline for 1 week. Even staff chief, there's a class that, where they come in and they teach you stuff. So there's always learning. And I think so the training and education is so ingrained, it's part of the FDNY's DNA. And because we've seen it, we know the value of that. And whether it's training when we come offline or we send our people to the Naval Postgraduate School, we've sent more than it's probably more than 50 by now to either their executive leadership program or their master's program. I'm a graduate of their master's program. And the majority of the FDNY staff currently and the most recent group that retired were all graduates of that program. So that's the educational component of it, which is important, as well as the training component of them. So both of them are very important to the success of the organization.
So officer development is definitely an important factor because it's easy to get promoted and easy for you to go, okay, they passed the test, they did their scenario, here you go, you're an officer. But without developing those individuals, they could be lost in a sense.
And they do get lost in departments that don't have that. They do get lost. I've seen that when as I go around and teach all over the place, I see that. Listen, you have to develop your officers. You can't just say, boom, raise your right hand. Now you're a lieutenant and expect them to know what they're doing when we didn't give it to them. Because as simple as, I'll go around and I'll teach about soft skill leadership. So what is soft skill leadership? Well, that's how to treat people. That really is what that is. It's what does empathy look like? What does it mean? How do you do conflict resolution? How do you treat people? What is servant leadership? It's the bedside manners, right? I think about the times that you pull up to the firehouse and you see somebody's car and you're like, oh man, I got to work with this guy tonight. I don't, maybe he took his medicine. Maybe he's off his meds. Who knows, right? You don't know which version of him you're going to get. Consistency, all of that, because we have to be brilliant at the basics. And we drill on the basics because that could kill us in 5 minutes from now. But we too often forget about those soft skill traits that really separate the good leader from the exceptional leader. Because the majority in the FDNY, all of the officers have the basics down. They couldn't pass the lieutenant's test if they didn't. But when it comes to management and leadership, do we, if we're not training them, then you're leaving it up to the individual. And even sometimes with the training, they still lack some of the soft skill leadership development. And to me, leadership development, soft skill, that should start with our lowest, with our entry level firefighters. Because if we don't give them any training until, poof, you're a lieutenant, and now we're going to give you training, it's kind of too late. So think about the most recent class that went into your department. For any of your listeners, think about the most recent class that you put in. One of those individuals in that class is likely to be a chief officer in your department in the next 20 years. Someone will definitely be an informal leader in the firehouse. Do we recognize that value and are we training them? Are we preparing them for that? Because if we start giving them a little bit of that as a new firefighter, that's a force multiplier. They're only going to get better. By the time they're actually in a leadership position, they're unstoppable. But what it winds up being is, and the argument against it is, I hear, well, we have to be worried about training them in the basics. I'm not saying don't train them in the basics. I'm saying add some of this training into it. Incorporate some of this training into it. Because boy, we wind up with a great generation of leadership when we educate them earlier on leadership. So just why wouldn't you educate a new member on leadership? The payback is significant in the future.
And would you say the people that you hung around, the mentors that you considered mentors, shaped you into becoming the person you are today?
There's no doubt about that. And as I look back to the most influential leaders in my career, every one of them had soft skills. Every one of them knew how to treat people first and foremost. It's amazing. And as you, the more you learn about it, the more you realize it. And think about the people that have shaped you, the people that you like. I know plenty of people that are brilliant at the basics, but I can't stand working with them. Because, or they, you know, that bedside manners, right? Those type of things. But you
Right.
know the people who are truly, they're the difference makers, they're the true difference makers in your department. In an organization like the FDNY, we have a deep bench. We have thousands of great officers. Literally thousands of great officers. And then we have a lot of them, but not as many, that are great officers, that are great leaders, that also know the that secret ingredient of soft skill leadership. They know how to treat people. They say and do the right thing at the right time. They just know. It seems like it's instinctual, but trust me, it's not instinctual. For some people it may be, but they've been exposed to people who have demonstrated that and they've learned it, or they've attended some type of class that makes them more aware of that, because awareness of it. And the FDNY, we have a partnership with the with Columbia University and General Electric, and we send people to these different classes, and they do a personality test on you, like a profile, and kind of rate you on what kind of person you are with all of these, and to bring a greater awareness to yourself of how you are, and how you perceive yourself, and how others perceive you. And that's important, right? You want that feedback from somebody and say, hey, do I connect with people in a good way? You know, ask somebody that. Now, they may lie to you. They may say, yeah, you do, because they're afraid you're going to yell at them, right?
Right.
You know, these are different things that that the FDNY does, and that we need to do as a fire service to make sure of that. Because again, think about the people that you want to be most like are brilliant at the basics, but they also know how to treat you the way you should be treated.
Okay. I did kind of forget to ask you this question earlier. In your opinion, what does the term aggressive mean to you? And did it change with each position you held, or did it remain constant?
So I think so aggressiveness doesn't necessarily change. I think your risk tolerance changes. And what do I mean by that? So a firefighter, there could be fire out 15 windows, and the firefighter is, let's go, let's go, let's go, let's go. Where the lieutenant maybe is going to hold you back a little bit. You know, the captain's going to say, let's put on all of our, you know, PPE. The chief may say, you know, you've been in there long enough. So I think as you move up the top, up this risk tolerance pyramid, your risk tolerance changes. But the our aggressiveness, our ability to be aggressive, is based on our training. So safety, and it's all interconnected when we talk about safety, aggressiveness. Because if I was to say, if you and I were standing out in front of a private dwelling and it was on fire, and I said to you, go search the second floor. The lady said there's two kids trapped in there. And so you're gonna, that's all, just go search it. And then I told the civilian that was standing next to me that has no fire training whatsoever, and I said the same thing, go search the second floor bedroom. And I also said, I want you to do it aggressively. I'm gonna get two different things. From you, I am gonna get a size up, and you are gonna determine the best way to aggressively get those children out, and the civilian is going to be more like a kamikaze and not know. So you have a couple of options. You could go in a front door, you could go in a window, but you see the window looks like it's about to light up. You see black fire. You see that we're about to have vent point ignition. It looks terrible. So you don't put a w you don't go up that window. You go to the roof, to the window on the other side of the house, or you recognize that's not a bedroom window. The civilian doesn't know. The civilian puts a ladder up to that window, goes in, and it's a bedroom, or it's the front window, but it happens to be there's no it's right above the first floor the door, and there's no floor. So this aggressively, the civilian goes in and falls down. You were aggressive in your size up, aggressive in your ladder placement based on your training, and saved the two kids. That's the difference. That's why. So it's safety, aggressive. It's all in the eyes of your training. It's all predicated on your training, because we could be aggressive and unsafe based on not knowing what the heck we're doing by not training. Training enables you to be aggressive. Training enables you to be safe. Because, I've never gone on the scene, especially as a firefighter. I don't recall ever getting on the scene and saying, "Oh, I better be safe here." But I remember getting on the scene and saying, "Whoa, look at the smoke. Whoa, look at this. Oh, there's a report of somebody trapped. Let me find something else." But I was never thinking about safety. But I was relying on all the different things that I know about training to be as aggressive as I can to save the lives that I can save. That's the difference. We seem to try and parse them out. But I don't think it's good for the fire service when we start parsing out safety, aggressive. It's all about training. You want to be aggressive. You want to be safe. You want to save lives. Train like your life and the lives of those that we are sworn to protect depend on it, because both your life and their life do depend on it. But yet too many people don't value training.
That's
And then,
fact.
and that's there is the problem. Right. And teamwork, right? Because we're a team, and mentorship, because all of that, it all blends into it. It's all part of it. It's all part of the ecosystem to be better.
Okay. In your opinion, what was the best position that you held throughout your entire career?
So that's like asking me which of my children do I love the most. But here's what I'll say. Nothing beats the nozzle position. There's nothing like having the nozzle at a really, really, really good fire. And anybody who tells you other has never had the nozzle at a really, really good fire. Because at a really, really good fire, where's the truck? They're behind the nozzle. They can't do anything until we start putting fire out. So that is the best individual position. The best position that I got the most fulfillment out of has got to be being a battalion chief. I was a battalion chief in one of the best battalions in the FDNY, in my opinion, Battalion 4-6. We went out the door all the time. We were busy. I loved the firefighters that I worked with. I loved all the firefighters in my battalion. Even the surrounding battalions, when we ran in with them, they were great firefighters, well trained into the job. And just your sphere of influence, and my ability to impact a greater number of people was I just loved it. And I didn't care. We ran all the time. We'd go to a gas leak, and I'd go to the back of the engine and be talking to the firefighters, and I just loved the interaction that I had with so many people at that rank. I often joke around that I studied myself out of a good job when I left that position.
Did you ever see yourself climbing all the way up to Deputy Assistant Chief?
No, not when I saw so there's people that come on a job today, they'll be like, I'm, their goal is to be a chief, but that wasn't a goal of, I didn't want to be, I never even thought of that until, my study group was, like I mentioned earlier, was a great study group. The people I studied with, some of them I studied with for every single rank. Some of them would become chief of department. My study group, we had four or five people that became staff chiefs. Our goal for each rank was to be promoted in time to take the next test and then see what would happen. But the goal was never to be to certainly not to go to staff chief. But it was just, I never wanted to put too much in, enjoy the rank you're at, enjoy what you're doing. And we worked hard. We worked hard to get promoted. And I would we would joke around, we may not be the smartest, but we'll put the time in to, to make it happen. We'll work harder than we'll outwork you. And that was true. We would outwork people, and we got and we were successful in that. We got promoted in time to lieutenant to take the captain's test, to take the chief's test, to take the deputy test. And yeah, it worked out. It worked out well. It was I have no regrets with any of that. I think I'm thrilled. I got to work in a couple of firehouses before I got promoted to lieutenant. I thought the 10 years, 10 and a half years was good. I got promoted to battalion chief with 19 years. And so from 19 years to just about 32, I was a chief officer for many years, and even a company officer for for even longer than that. So I think I did 13 years as a chief and over 20 as a company, or around 20 as a company officer. I'm not a math wizard. I'm a firefighter, so my math might be off a little bit, but it's a long time in being in different leadership positions. And I think there's really the number one message is stay learnable, stay into the job. It's okay to love the job. I still love the job. I still love the FDNY, even though I retired. You never leave the FDNY. You can retire, but you never leave the brother and sisterhood of the family. There's different events that you go to and you see people. And I went back recently and taught a leadership class there and a cancer awareness class. So, it's I know you love the job, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, one question I have for you, as that high position of your deputy assistant chief, should one of the focuses be for anyone listening, if they want to obtain that position or that top spot, is to never forget where you came from? Because that seems to happen easily with certain individuals.
Yeah, I certainly never forgot where I came from. But that's—I mean—I have a genuine love of my firefighters, and I know what they do. I wouldn't ask them to do anything I wouldn't do myself. And I just think, yeah, you never forget where you came from. Understand your position. Understand their job. Understand the challenges that they have as well. And if you do that and stay connected to the firefighters, I never lost connection with the brothers and sisters that were getting the job done. And I think that's important. And I remember when Tom Richardson was the chief of our department. He was the chief a couple of chiefs ago now, but he would start every day at headquarters and he'd say, "How can we best serve the men and women that are getting on the fire trucks and ambulances today?" And that was kind of how the day started. And it was about never forgetting about what the mission of our department is, never forgetting the quality of people that we have. As I mentioned earlier, the FDNY has a deep bench. We play to win on every tour, every run, every day. Losing's not an option. And that needs to start at the top of the organization and filter its way down, because then that same love of the job resonates with our newest members of the department, and that resonates up. And so when you have that bi-directional flow coming up and down the organization, that is a winning formula.
Okay. With that being said, you are the managing director of First Responder Center for Excellence. I don't know much about it, but since I have you on here, can you tell us what that organization does and stands for?
Sure. Yeah, like you mentioned, I became the managing director of them. I've been involved with them for a number of years, and for me, I like to tell Victor Stagnaro is the CEO of the National Fallen Firefighter Foundation and also the CEO of our organization, because we're an affiliate of the National Fallen Firefighter Foundation. And my job is to make sure that your family doesn't prematurely meet the members that do a great job at the National Fallen Firefighter Foundation, because that means that you've lost your life in the line of duty, whether that is on the fire ground, whether that is to occupational cancer. Soon suicide is going to be included on that. So my goal is to put the NFFF out of business by making it where they don't have any firefighters to honor, or at least make the number as low as possible, because they honor way too many firefighters every year by putting them on their memorial wall. Typically, it's over 200 firefighters a year from all of those different things. We lose under 100 firefighters on scene, way under 100 firefighters on scene. And that's because we've haven't, we've kept our eye on the ball and we've tracked small failures and understand where we could do better. And we have our procedures are better because of those, because of that paying attention that we do. But when it comes to cancer, when it comes to cardiac, all of these different things, we our mental health, we need to do better. We can do better. And for me, that's why I took this position, because what we do here is we offer different online resources and different online classes. You go to our website, you can follow us on social media, First Responder Center for Excellence. We're on all the different social media platforms. And by following us, whenever we have a new class or we're doing something or we're going to be at a conference, we'll let you know about it. And we also do live, we do in-person training as well. We're connected with the researchers. A lot of times we are the translators of the research. So researchers come out with something, they do great research. And then what's the deliverable to the fire service? Well, we help translate that to the fire service, whether it's, how do we clean our hoods, whether it's, decon wipes, best procedures for mental health, for sleep. Sleep deprivation is a problem. So we translate a lot of that research into the fire service.
Okay. Now, with you being retired, have you found yourself trying to somewhat get back to normalcy? Because, like, I'm sure when you slept at the firehouse and sleeping at home now, two different things, correct?
Oh yeah, and even what you eat is different, right? The firehouse meals and all. Yeah, so that's been different. I'm fairly busy. I'm on the road a lot. I go to a decent amount of conferences, and go to different firehouses and teach different classes and stuff. So I've been pretty busy. But it's different to have a home-cooked meal and to sleep in a non-firehouse environment where the tones aren't going off and waking you up, from the limited sleep that you or naps that you're trying to get. So yeah, that's definitely been a difference. Yeah.
Okay. I always like to ask the guests before they, as a last question, where would you like to see yourself retire before, or where would you like to see yourself before you decide to hang it up? And you've obviously you've retired as Deputy Assistant Chief. You said earlier you've never thought that you would get to that position, but in a couple more years down the line, do you see yourself completely disengaging and straight family life, or like what does the future hold for you?
God, it's a good question. No, I don't ever see myself abandoning the fire service in some way. I just love it too much. But I incorporate my family into it wherever I can, whether they come with me on a trip or different things like that. I try and do my best to put my family first. I think we in the fire service, especially when you're climbing the ladder and you're, well, there's mandatory overtime, it's very hard to do that. But we have to do all we can to put our family first. Otherwise, they won't be there for us. When we get to retirement. So I'm enjoying myself. I still go around. I love to travel. I love to teach. I'm doing a lot of both of that right now. I love my family and I bring them with me when I can and spend as much time as I can with them. And I think I'll slow down a little bit, but I'll never get out of, when we're talking about years down the road, but I don't ever see myself just quitting the fire service. It's been too much a part of my life. I enjoy it and love it too much to not have it as part of my life.
Okay. Engine or truck? What was Chief Frank Leeb's niche when it came to the fire service? What was your passion?
So certainly I was in engine companies, more so even when I was in special operations. A squad company is an engine company. As I mentioned, putting the fire out is I just love that. But searching and finding a victim, or having the can or the irons, those were the other positions that I would love to have, because you're inside the building, is what I really enjoyed the most. But as I mentioned earlier, there's nothing like having the nozzle at a good fire. And anybody who says otherwise never did.
Chief, I appreciate you taking time out of your day to do this. It means the world to me that I got to actually ask you questions and hear how you grew through the ranks and your mindset when it comes to the fire service. So I just want to say thank you very much. And with you teaching and going around, how can somebody contact you if they would like for you to come to their organization?
Yeah, so you could. I'm on several of the social media sites. So Cornerstones of Leadership on Facebook is the best way to get in touch with me there. On LinkedIn, on Linktree. Linktree is probably the best way. If you Google my name, if you just put Frank Lieb Linktree, on the Linktree, there's an avenue to contact me. I'm on X. So, but yeah, I'm not that difficult to get in touch with. I'm difficult to schedule maybe, but as you know, but man, listen, I am so appreciative of you. I'm appreciative of you having me on the show. I'm appreciative of what you do to make our amazing profession better. We are truly the lucky ones. And we're lucky that we have people like you that have a podcast and are trying to make our profession better today than it was yesterday, and better tomorrow than it is today. And if we keep doing that, our profession is in great shape. So thank you.
Thank you for the words, Chief. Like I said, I appreciate your time very, very much.
Thank you, brother.
If any of the listeners out there are or know of a great firefighter who embodies the principles of being a great communicator, goal-oriented, hardworking, humble, passionate, and professional, regardless of rank, career, or volunteer, contact me at studentofthegamefirepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, stay focused, stay committed, and stay safe.